This is RÚV English Radio with Darren Adam, daily English language radio from Iceland's national broadcaster, RÚV.
Hello, this is RÚV English Radio. I'm Darren Adam. Thanks very much for your company on this Monday. Time for an episode of The Week in Iceland, joined once again by my colleague here, Ingunn Lára Kristjánsdóttir. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Darren. Lovely to see you.
Great to have you back on the show once again. Now, we actually are having our conversation at 1:38 in the afternoon. We don't yet know, as we sit here, if the ice caves will reopen in time for their scheduled reopening tomorrow. You'll of course remember there was a terrible accident, a fatality in these ice caves in the east of Iceland. The plan was for the ice caves not to open until much later in the season, when it's colder, when the ice is more solid. There's a possibility they will reopen tomorrow, pending some checks that are going on at the moment. So a lot of uncertainty around this.
Yes. So if we don't get a proper answer in the next day or two, some industries, some like big tourist industry figures will have to, well, make up for all that lost money. They were talking about a month that might open in November, but a month out of your business, I mean, that's a big hole.
Yes, it is. And it could have been later, of course, because the Regional Council of the National Park first suggested the start of December for the opening. It was the board of the park that said the inspections could begin on the 1st of November. But of course, as we know, there are people who book tours starting as early as tomorrow. And I think the case that the companies are making is we don't want to be tied to the calendar. We want to be tied to checks as to whether this is safe or not, which feels like a reasonable point.
Yeah.
But how often would you need to inspect? Because these, I don't know, these weaknesses could appear at any moment.
And I mean, especially this time of the year when everything in nature is constantly changing. This is the time that we have, you know, we can have landslides. Same thing happens in the spring because there's a big change in the nature. We can have more flooding. So, you know, I keep thinking of the people that are booking these trips as well. I mean, I don't know if I would dare go after those horrific news we got.
Yes. Well, as I said to you earlier on, before we switched on the microphones, I wouldn't go anyway because I'm just not great in any kind of confined space. So I wouldn't enjoy the experience even if it was the dead of winter. But that's just me. I think there are tourists who see going to an ice cave as an Icelandic thing to do. It's on the list of activities that make sense to do when you're here. I would share your, if not skepticism, then caution.
And it is, certainly. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. It is one of a kind. And, you know, to keep it fair, the majority of the companies that do these tours are being safe, checking, and are experts. You know, they go in there, they check out the place, and they don't go in there unless they know that it is safe. But within all the capitalist systems, there are going to be those that push the boundaries and are just trying to get those extra trips in, just to get a little extra buck. I mean, the same thing happened a few years ago when a big, like a mountaineering group went up on a glacier with a group of 40 people, families, young children down to 10-year-olds, maybe younger, going on these sledding trips, you know, like motorized sleds. And at the same time, we knew that we were getting severe weather warnings. And they said, okay, well, these weather warnings, they're not going to really start until at this time of this day. So we're going to go anyway earlier in the day. And these people all got stuck on the glacier in horrible weather conditions. You know, they got, they got lost, they got tired. And finally, when we got them down from the mountain, they were all traumatized.
Yeah.
And their hands and toes, you know, almost at the point of falling off. It was horrific.
Yes.
There are always going to be those, you know, the black sheeps in the tourist industry that will push and push and push. And we hear these stories working here in news media. But all the same, the vast majority are not going to put people into unsafe conditions.
This is a cold and brutal country in many ways. And it is the cold and the brutality that makes it so beautiful in many cases.
Yeah, the wilderness we have and the fact that we don't really disturb it that much.
Yes. which means that there aren't facilities there for when someone gets into trouble because they've been led there by a company that maybe shouldn't have led them there in the first place. Now, what's also really interesting and still staggering to me about this story from Breiðar Merkurjökull, mm-hmm. not just the tragedy of the person that lost their life, but you will recall, of course, that for days afterwards, or a couple of days at mm-hmm. least, the rescue operation continued mm-hmm. because it was wrongly believed that two more people were still trapped mm-hmm. under the ice
yeah.
at great expense, causing great trauma for everybody involved, mm-hmm. having to sort of break through the ice basically with their bare hands.
Yeah, those rescue workers yeah. just putting themselves into even more danger.
Because they couldn't get heavy machinery up onto the
yeah,
the ice cave for obvious
reasons. There's always the risk that there's going to be another collapse.
Yeah, you make it less secure yeah. by digging into it. And of course, this was for nothing because there were no people there. And the reason mm-hmm. that this rescue operation continued is because proper records were not mm-hmm. kept of the number of people who were actually in the ice cave, mm-hmm. which really feels like the most basic thing that needs to happen.
Yes, but in these industries, you know, knowing some people that work there, there's sometimes a lot of rush. Yeah. And a lot of just getting, like, yeah, just, like, get in there. Yeah, it's fine. It's this whole idea of, yeah, it's fine.
It's a touch of theta redas going on, isn't it?
Yeah, and I know, like, sometimes it's really great for us, especially in, you know, horrible times where you go, oh, we'll just get through this. Like, it'll be fine. But then, on the other hand, maybe there's a bit of carelessness as well.
Yeah. I mean, it feels to me like keeping a record of who's in the cave is an easy fix, mm-hmm. you know, just yeah. counting the number of people that are actually
think,
on the trip.
Yeah.
We'll start with that. Talking of counting, the inflation rate in Iceland has fallen to its lowest
yeah.
level since the end of 2021. So it's now 5.4%, still mm-hmm. quite high by standards of some neighbouring countries.
Yeah, but I mean, only just a few years ago, it was around, like, what was it, like 2%?
Yeah, and it's been as high as, I think, 10 or 11. So
yeah.
so it's down from where it was, still quite high compared with some neighbouring countries. But now that it's down to 5.4%, having fallen from 6, mm-hmm. so quite a fall in 1 month, this is the annual rate, it's gone down by that month to month,
mm-hmm.
The SGS Union Federation, among those saying, now can we please, in the name of all you find holy, have an interest rate cut? Because the interest rates are still at 9.25% yeah. and they've been there for a year.
Oh, yeah, they've been there for a while,
yeah.
haven't they?
Yeah.
And we are still waiting on those news.
Wednesday.
Wednesday, we're going to know. And again, like, I don't think there's going to be a big change. Well, maybe, you know, maybe this time. But the thing that happens now, because of this big lowering, people are going to be able to purchase more, to buy more, which, again, might push it up again. So this is what happens. And
then everyone gets blamed for going on holiday to
yeah,
Tenerife.
Yeah, yeah. Let's all blame the people wanting to enjoy their lives. But this is the thing. And they have been very, very cautious. And I don't really see any, like, signs that they're going to change from that course. I mean, I hope, as a consumer with a loan, I really do hope.
Yes. Well, many people, of course, in that position. I guess the risk is that if inflation does fall, you know, by this sort of rate,
mm-hmm.
if it goes from 6% to 5.4% in the month, then the central bank will say, see, it's working. We're going to keep interest rates high
yeah.
because we know it's working. If it hadn't gone down,
mm-hmm.
they would say, oh, there's still more to do. We're going to keep interest rates high. So there's a bit of that going on, I think. But at some point, surely,
mm-hmm.
surely the central bank will say, well, we can maybe risk a quarter percentage point cut.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Well, we'll know on Wednesday.
Yeah, there we go. I still feel like food prices are gone so much up.
Yes.
Like every time yes. I go and you know, buy my weekly dose of nutrients, it stings.
Mm.
It stings how much food costs.
It really does.
Which is interesting. At the same time, did you see the price of, like, trips to Tenerife are going down?
Yes, and the cost of eating in the canteen has plummeted, mainly because
yeah.
you now get free meals in schools.
In the school. Canteen. What do you think of that thing? There's been so much discussion about the free meals for children in schools.
I think as a principle, it's a really good idea for a couple mm-hmm. of reasons. The first reason is that if you make something universal, you don't then have to worry about the costs of finding out who's entitled to it. So
mm-hmm.
there's an administrative cost saving there.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I don't know whether it's true in Iceland. It used to be true in the UK many years ago that when people were on school meals or free school meals, there was a stigma around that. So people who, for whatever reason, were entitled to free school meals because of the family's financial situation, for example, they were sometimes picked on. There was a stigma around that. Was it the case here in Iceland that free school meals were given to people or children from families with low incomes?
No, for me, like when I was in school, it was just for everyone.
That
was the free meal for everyone. And I think, you know, having special, I think you're right. If that would be the case,
but it wasn't
it
here.
Could be, create a stigma. The thing is, like, I don't think there was. But the thing is, like, when you're a kid, you don't really know. Like, who's paying for my meal? I just show up and eat it.
Well, I mean, I remember going back to when I was in primary school in the UK, which is 1,000 years ago. We'll go back to the days of days of settlement for this. You know? But incredibly, the children who were on free school meals were given a ticket which was a different colour.
So it was
visibly and very obviously visible straight away. Now, of course, you had to know that that's what the system meant before people could then pick on those
kids.
But
I'm guessing it didn't take them. Yeah,
exactly.
God. But it was interesting when, one of the heads of the government were talking about how, we need to stop giving out free school meals because people don't, I don't know how the wording was, but that people didn't really appreciate it. And, you know, it won't really solve many problems and it's too much of a cost. And obviously people were furious. They were like, well, do you know what? It actually is a problem for many people. Not everyone can afford the price of school meals every single day. And it's going to be so much more worth it in the long run that everyone has proper nutrients.
And it helps, it seems, to knock 6.6 of a percentage point off the rate of inflation.
Yeah.
So maybe there is some benefit there. Who knows? We shall see. Now, I want to turn to a story that concerns Elko. This is the electronics shop that's been around in Iceland for a couple of decades at least. Mm-hmm. And some of the goods that were stolen, I think a week ago, from Elko have been recovered. Police hope that many more will be recovered as well. Basically, mobile phones.
Yeah, small electronics, which are, you know, easy to move from country to country. And four people have been questioned by the police, but they do suspect that this is a part of a bigger ring of, basically an international crime gang, which is usually the case. There are no borders in organized crime.
No.
And so smaller electronics are, you know, easier to move from country to country.
Isn't a mobile phone, though, an incredibly stupid thing to steal, given that you can call the operators and you've got the serial number, so you can call any provider and say, do not activate this particular phone?
Oh, interesting. Well, I'm guessing they probably have like teams of people that can sort of work around it.
Or hack them and make them network free. And the size of these items, as you say, if you are... Not that I can get inside the mind of a criminal mastermind because I'm not one, but if you are involved in international organized crime, it's going to be easier, isn't it, to transport 20 stolen mobile phones than 20, 120 centimeter screen televisions.
Yeah, well, there you go. Oh, have you, there's this woman on TikTok. I don't know if you've been following this. It's really hilarious.
I need to get into TikTok
with
your help.
You need to get more into TikTok. I will get you there, okay. Darren. But there is this woman, she's really hilarious. She was on holiday in Spain. So she was, I think she was around, I don't know, either Barcelona or Madrid, like one of the bigger cities, and her phone got stolen. But she has one of those, you know how on iPhones you can track your phone's location?
Mm.
So she had that on the whole time, and she's been tracking her phone's travel around the world. So apparently it went like to the south of Spain, crossed the strait into Morocco, and now it's somewhere in north of Africa. And not joking, she got like messages from the guy that stole her phone that was like asking for her passcode so he could wipe the phone clean. And she has like all of their like interactions. But it was, it's just really interesting to see how one stolen good, like where it will travel to and where it will stay for a while.
Of course, the technology has to work though, because my partner gave me a travel suitcase a few years ago, which was really nice. It had a battery built in, so you could use like USB items, you could charge them up from the suitcase. And it also had not a GPS chip, but it had a Bluetooth chip in it and software that would crowdsource its location. So if it went missing, you could go onto the website and see where the case was. Now, it never went missing for me, but I did check a few times just to see where it was. And this crowdsourcing software repeatedly told me that my suitcase, which was sitting next to me, was in fact in a small village in Argentina. Every time I checked.
So not the perfect technology.
No, as a proof of concept, it failed, unfortunately. And then, actually, the airline started to ban these so-called smart cases. Mm. If they've got their own battery built in, then they're not safe on board. So I wasn't able to use it to, as I was doing at the time, fly between Edinburgh and London every couple of weeks. So a bit of a failure. A lovely case, nice present, but a bit of a technological failure.
Cases that you have.
Yes,
or I didn't know that this was a thing.
Well, it's not, because airlines won't let them on now with the battery, unfortunately.
Oh, shame.
But the location part of the proposition didn't work very well. Never been.
I wonder if Elko was able to track down their stolen goods this way, or are the criminal gangs quite smart now and high tech and are.
Yeah,
somehow deactivating this.
I don't think they would have had time, because these people who are alleged to have been involved in the theft, they were apprehended at the airport quite quickly. So if there was some sort of software trick that needed to be performed, they probably wouldn't have had time, I would have thought.
Mm.
Let's turn to the fire service in Fjallabyggð, who are very concerned that they don't have enough preparedness if there is a fire in any of the tunnels in that part of Iceland, which includes, I think, the longest tunnel in Iceland at 11 kilometres, is in that municipality.
It's kind of like two tunnels that are connected in one, but together they are 11 kilometres long. And you remember that bus fire the other day.
In a different tunnel.
It was right outside of Vestfjarðargöng, right by Ísafjörður in the Westfjords. This is the longest continuous tunnel in Iceland.
And this connects Siglufjörður with Ólafsfjörður.
No, the one where the fire was.
Sorry, but the one in the municipality we're about to talk about was
the longest one
between those two towns.
Yeah, yeah.
But the fire, as you say, in the Westfjords, just outside of that tunnel.
Yeah, Vestfjarðargöng.
And the fear there was that if that fire had taken place, if that bus had caught fire inside the tunnel, who knows what would have happened.
Yeah, and it was a part of these five buses bringing tourists from one of the ships in Ísafjörður to show them around. So it was five buses in a row. I mean, you can imagine what would have happened inside those tunnels. But so the fire brigade by Siglufjörður?
In Fjallabyggð, yes.
Yeah.
They're concerned that they are not sufficiently prepared if a fire does happen like that. For example, in this very long tunnel between Siglufjörður and Ólafsfjörður, which is 11 kilometres. And if you drive through a lot of tunnels in Iceland, you will see what look like sort of refuge areas off to the side.
Yeah.
But of course, they don't lead to the surface.
No. Those are just if in the case where two vehicles will meet each other and one has to sort of go to the side. Well, in Fjallabyggð, Strákagöng, which is just a one-lane tunnel.
Yes.
And honestly, the roads there are in dire need of repair. These are very, very dangerous situations without a fire.
Yeah, yeah. And they're also quite confusing. I think if people aren't used to them, they don't know perhaps if they have right of way as they drive through, when you sort of get used to it and you can work it out. But if someone is maybe, I don't know, landing in Akureyri or an international flight and driving in Iceland for the first time, and they go through a one-way tunnel such as this one, they might not necessarily realise straight away that it's their job to get over to the side to let oncoming traffic through. There's a lot that could be improved far as the tunnels are concerned.
I remember when I drove the first time on the left side of the road in the UK, and I went to one of those smaller, tiny little roads where everyone is driving super fast. And I'm like, how do you drive so fast on this tunnel? On the left side, that freaked me out. I cannot imagine coming to Iceland and going to these off the beat tracks and then going into the scary, long, dark tunnel.
Yes.
And
it's quite an experience.
Yeah.
But maybe those refuge areas, and you do see them in some tunnels, I think part of what needs to be built into the system as an emergency response is an area where people, if the worst happens, can get out of the tunnel behind a closed door into a ventilated space at the very least until fire services are able to do what they need to do, because at the moment there is just nowhere to go.
Yeah, and some of these tunnels are getting a bit old.
Yes.
But you can imagine the the cost of creating ventilation, like in the middle of a mountain tunnel.
Yeah.
And I mean, and if it's really like realistic that they'll actually put money into this.
Mm. And a lot of money as well would be needed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just the amount of money to create a tunnel. The people in the Westfjords, you know, they often talk about how they always get left behind because there's so few of them living there
that the
government will think, well, it's not really worth it for this amount of people. But when they opened those tunnels, especially in the Westfjords, it opened up a whole world for people to not be in complete isolation all year round. Because those, especially in the winters, it can become very, very, like...
Yes, and that tunnel connects Suðureyri to Ísafjörður and more or less to Flateyri, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, to Flateyri. Yeah. And then you can basically go the south road or the northern road to get to Ísafjörður. And I know they're doing some, they're doing massive changes to the road system, the sort of south way towards Ísafjörður, which will shorten the way quite a bit. Because I don't know if you've been like Ísafjörður djúpið, fjord, back and forth, back and forth. It is a long way to go.
You spend the whole journey counting the fjords, don't you?
Yeah.
I was there recording for Roof English Radio last year, and I did most of my recordings. Most of the work was on the Ísafjörður. I flew into Ísafjörður and picked up a hire car and drove around and did most of the recordings that I needed to do on the Ísafjörður side of things.
Ah.
But on the Friday before I flew back, I had one recording to do in Hommervik.
Oh, wow.
so I
had
spent
to go
most
that
of
way.
That day driving best part of three hours from Ísafjörður to Hommervik and then back, because that's where I was flying from. And I would have been just about as quick if I'd driven back from Hommervik to Reykjavik.
No, I think it's the same amount of time, even though it looks on a map to be so much closer.
Yes.
I think it's the same amount of time.
It's about the same amount of time, but then I'd have had to apologise to Avis for leaving their car in the wrong place. So that's why I didn't do that. Also, I think all my stuff was still in the hotel. But anyway, it's a very, very, very long, it's a beautiful drive.
Yeah.
But if you do it regularly, I can imagine that people might find it a bit tedious to go up and down all those fjords every single time.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's the hope that the road network will improve in the Westfjords and indeed other parts of Iceland as well. But this year, for our summer holiday, for our sumafri, we went to the Westfjords and drove around quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And some of the roads, I mean, you talked about being in the UK in, you know, driving in fairly
narrow... small country roads,
small country roads. I present to you, in that case, the road to Roiðasandur, for example, which is very narrow and very, very twisty. And it's not the only road like that in the Westfjords.
No, we have quite a lot of roads. It almost... it's so funny when we were talking about these news, how almost, I don't know what it is. Like, sometimes I feel like we're a bit far behind the other country. Well, but when you, I keep thinking of, because when we're talking about these accidents in the tourist industry, a lot of the time there's a lack of, signs, like clear signposts about the dangers of the area. I remember being younger and thinking, well, if people are stupid enough to get into, you know, the trouble, if they're going to be leaning over a cliff with a huge drop down into the ocean, it's that whole, like, well, it's a Darwin thing.
Yeah, no more clues.
Yeah, but now it's like, well... let's make a risk assessment and think, is it going to cost us that much to put up a sign to...
Yeah, even a sign in many cases would be worthwhile.
There is, people often talk about the lack of clear signs and fences in Nordic countries.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've been to Norway and you've been to one of those gorgeous fjords, it'll be like a steep cliff and a big drop down. No signs, no rails, just very...
But I see
undisturbed
people,
nature.
I don't like heights or confined spaces, as we discussed earlier on, but I don't like heights. And so people who are photographed, there's a lot of this in Norway, sitting on the edges of cliffs with their legs dangling over into the deep
to get a bit of vertigo when you see those pictures.
I can't understand how people can do that, whether there's a sign or not. One of the places that we went on our trip was to Bulafjell, to the viewing platform, right the very northwest tip. We couldn't see Greenland. I don't think the laws of physics actually permit you to see that far across the water, despite what people say. But I was struck by just how easy it was to get to the very edge of that cliff. Mm-hmm. And it is a cliff.
And it's almost like in our little bubble-wrapped world, especially people that live in big cities, we're not. It's almost like we're not used to having the free will of thinking, oh, I can actually, yeah, I'm very, very close to danger, because we're so used to living in this bubble-wrapped technical world. Whereas, I don't know if have you traveled a lot around the US?
Yes, yes.
Everything is very clearly signposts everywhere.
Well, that's because they're terrified of being sued.
That's what I keep thinking. It's a lawsuit thing, because they're very, very dugleg to sue everyone.
Yeah, yeah. And you can... gets us into sort of American jurisprudence, but if you look at some of these cases, I mean, someone might slip on the floor of a burger restaurant and sue that chain for like $50 million
or something,
you know. So, yes, it is
so
a very...
So why wouldn't you just sue the heck out of everyone?
Exactly. And if you lived in that country and you ran a business in that country, you'd make sure there were signs every the hell where.
And I'm guessing there's, you know, I keep remembering those old Hollywood films of these con artists just really trying to get a buck out of every single loophole that they could find.
Yes. Well, that's not what Iceland is. And that maybe explains why we don't have these signs everywhere.
Yeah, it hasn't been really a part of the law and culture here.
And you think that's great, and it is most of the time, but then when we have the eruptions, there's always one, isn't there? Mm. But, you know, we can see the cameras all the time. The webcams are pointed at these things.
Constant feed.
And there's always someone who walks up or tries to walk up either to the edge of or actually climb an erupting volcano.
Yeah, I'll never forget the first time I saw helicopter footage which showed a person on the edge of a crater, like at the very top of a crater with active, it was active at the time. You could see hot lava within the crater, and that person had walked all the way up there. And I kept thinking, my God, we're going to see someone fall into like magma life. And I've never been so scared of watching that live feed. My God.
And if you're wondering why we don't put signs up there, it's because the sign would burst into flames.
Maybe we need to just have like helicopters flying around with one of those, you know, where they drag the billboards behind them.
With a banner behind them saying, if you can read this, you're too damn close. Run away. Run away. Well, that's the first mention in this episode of The Week in Iceland of eruptions. As we sit here, by the way, if you're wondering, if you're listening somewhere around the world, nothing is currently erupting, but magma continues to accumulate in the place where it's been accumulating for the last six. So by the end of the year, probably.
Yeah.
I would think so.
I mean, at this point, it's so regular that it's almost like, we're just waiting for the next one.
Yes.
Isn't that an interesting thing? It's such a certainty at this point.
What I found interesting was that at the start of this cycle, and I sort of count last November as the start of this cycle, because the previous eruptions had been beautiful and safe and very sort of tourist friendly, but also resident friendly. They happened in a place that no one was going to be imperiled by. Obviously, that changed in November with the quakes, the damage done to Grindavik, the evacuation, and the fact that there's this uncertainty all the time.
And when we realised the sinkhole was, going into the town.
From that point onwards, back in November, I think one day last year I spoke to 9 international media companies around the world because they were so interested in the story. Now, when it goes off, nothing. Crickets. Because they've learned that actually this is not having, you know, other than dreadful continuing uncertainty for people in Grindavik, this is not something that affects the vast majority of people in Iceland. It doesn't affect us here in the capital. It doesn't affect international flights. It doesn't affect anyone really outside of that triangle of the you know, the Blue Lagoon and Svartsengi and Grindavík.
Yeah, it's almost become this like a curiosity piece around Grindavík and Blue Lagoon.
Yes. Yeah. So that is a change I've definitely noticed, and that's not even been a year over which that change has happened.
Wow.
Something that is happening towards the end of the year, and if you know me at all, you'll know that I've saved my favourite story till last, which is that Reykjavík is to be officially a Christmas city.
Christmas city!
The city council has set aside quite a chunky sum of money to make Reykjavík as festive as possible in December, not just for locals, not just for other visitors from around Iceland, not just for foreign tourists, but for everybody who is in Reykjavík during December. And it's already quite a Christmassy place.
It is. Are you a big, like, a Christmas child?
Like you would not believe.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
Interesting.
Yeah. Did you not see what I did to our desk here at Roof last?
Oh, actually, yeah. You really liked putting up those lovely decorations.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's Christmas in my head all year round. It's the 30th of September today. We're putting up the winter lights tonight.
Oh.
And I'll have the tree up in a month.
You know what? I do like lovely winter lights because our winters can get quite dark here. So for me, it's not just the Christmas thing. It is a winter thing.
And that's why you will see what appear to be Christmas decorations or Christmas lights up for about 3 or 4 months in a lot of places in Iceland. But as you say, for many people, it's about winter lights, not so much as Christmas lights. That's what I tell my partner anyway, who doesn't like Christmas as much as me.
Oh,
so he needs to be persuaded that actually it's not a Christmas thing that we're doing.
Do you find there's a big difference between sort of the festive spirit here compared to in the UK?
Do you know what?
Or like the
what I have found is that this is a much more Christmassy country. I mean, technically it's Yule and Yule.
Yeah.
But it's the same sort of spirit, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've discovered is that the shops here will have Christmas stuff in them much later than in the UK.
Oh, yeah.
You start to see all the Christmas confectionery, all the Jólanami, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You start to see that from the middle of August, really, in the UK.
Oh, wow.
If you look for it. I'm always looking for it. But here, not really so much. Maybe Halloween has to happen first and then Christmas takes
over. Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, it doesn't start quite early. I remember when I was living in London and seeing those massive decorations going up on Regent Street and Oxford Street.
Yeah.
And that coming in like quite early. For me, it's like, oh, it's not really Christmas yet, is it? But my memories of Christmas in Iceland, it's always like dancing around the jólatré, the Christmas tree, and making laufabrauð.
Yes.
Do you make laufabrauð?
I haven't made it. I have bought some, certainly. I'm not sure if I've got the culinary cooking skills necessary, but it looks like it's quite easy to make.
Yeah, and it's such a lovely, like a family thing, like or friends coming together, making laufabrauð, making your own little symbols into the bread. And of course, jólagløgg. But you do that in the UK, mulled wine.
Mulled wine, yeah, which is not very nice. Not really.
It's similar. It's very like, I think the UK and the Nordic countries, there are many, many similarities in the Christmas traditions.
I think so. I think the further north you go, certainly the more similarities you will find. But there is a tradition that I got on board with for the first time last year. And this is how bad I am at cooking, right? For the first time, I think ever, I tried to bake something.
Yeah.
Which was a cookie, Christmas cookies. You know, from the tubes that you can buy. You can buy tubes of ready.
Oh, yeah.
It's basically ready-made dough.
Yeah, you're just cutting it into a tiny little
balls. Yeah, so that's all I had to do was cut it into balls.
I love how you said baking, and I'm like, oh, you no, that's not baking, Derek.
I'll tell you how badly wrong this went and how little I knew. I didn't know that you had to put the icing on after.
No. Did you put it on the wall? Did you put it into the oven?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, Darren.
And so there was like yellow icing that just exploded all over the place. And, I mean, it still tasted fine. But took the cookies out of the oven.
You had one task, Darren.
One job. Took the cookies out of the oven, and we just thought, what manner of terrible thing has happened here? Because they were supposed to have little eyes and mouths and noses, but it was just this explosion of yellow all over. All over them. So that wasn't great. I'll know not to make the same mistake again this year. But at least the dough was already cooked, I suppose, wasn't it? So we weren't going to get food poisoning by not having them in long enough. To go back to the plans, you'll be unsurprised to learn that the council is not planning to hire me as the chef.
Such a shame.
Such a shame for Jølborgin 2024, Christmas town, Christmas city. Reykjavik will continue being built up as a Christmas city in the coming years. There have already, of course, been various events and various initiatives. The Christmas cat downtown, which gets lit.
That's been like one of my favorite. Like, it's a new tradition, but it's really nice and like honors these like old Christmas stories of Iceland.
And that's very Icelandic, isn't it?
Yeah, the Christmas cat.
That's something
it's
you
not
find
cute. It that is a scary animal.
It is scary.
That will eat children.
It will eat children who've been unfortunate enough not to get new clothes at Christmas. So imagine that.
How horrifying is that?
You're a kid. You already feel bad because you've not been given new clothes, and now you're getting eaten by a cat.
Yeah, that cat hates the poor. The poor.
It's the only explanation that makes any sense. And there have been Christmas events in the zoo taking place, at the museum at Árbæjar.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favourites because I grew up in Árbæjar.
Okay.
So, Árbæjarsafn and Elliðaárdalur. Oh.
Is that that's the open air museum?
Yeah, open air museum. Yeah, all of these like old traditional Icelandic houses. Oh, it is gorgeous during like the festive season. Definitely recommended.
So the plan is to build on that work. The plan is to increase the number of opportunities to come to Reykjavik and enjoy it as a Christmas destination.
I like that. Do you know, there is, because this reminds me, there's a town in Alaska called the North Pole.
Yes.
They have
made... I
still
want to go there.
Like, I remember looking up sort of the industries there, because I was like, okay, the North Pole in Alaska, they make a lot of money during the Christmas season because it becomes a massive tourist area. Mm. Within, like, in basically in a month or two, it gets filled with people from all over the world going to see the North Pole in Alaska. Mm. And I kept thinking, oh, I wonder if there's a big tourist industry there. Not at all. Big coal and like mining town, and their biggest industry basically just public offices and mining and industry and
they
manufacturing.
They are missing a trick, aren't they?
Right, but they only have to put in a lot of sort of work and money and get some like people to work around Christmas. That's the only sort of booming tourist time they have. Hmm. Rest of the year. Just a regular Alaskan mining town.
There are people that would go there in March. Okay, that's me. I would go
you
there.
You would go
March.
There to and, the any, North Pole.
But there
Alaska.
Are enough people who are Christmas obsessed. I mean, we've got a Christmas shop that exists all year round in Reykjavik, of course. And I think if you made your town or your city, you know, the capital of Christmas, like Mariah Carey owns Christmas.
Yeah.
Reykjavik could own Christmas.
Yeah, do you know what? And this is Iceland. Yeah. We need to think about the ideas that come into people's heads when they hear Iceland.
I'm going to put an idea out now. I've only mentioned this to a couple of Icelandic friends who were quite polite when I suggested it. I think we should combine Christmas, which Iceland ought to be more well known for, with something that Iceland is very well known for. I present to you Jólalaug.
What?
The Christmas pool.
Oh, the Christmas pool. And what would that entail?
Well, instead of going down the flumes, you go down like on Santa's sled into the water.
Oh.
You've got snow all around, artificial snow when you're sitting in the pool. You've got Mariah Carey playing. It's about as far as I've got with the concept. But
I like that idea. I can kind of see it now. Frozen winters around, capybaras in the pool, swimming around.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I can see where you're going with
this. I
think
it could run all year round. I don't have the skill to run a swimming pool without it ending in some dreadful accident. So I'm going to delegate that to someone else.
There you go. You can only be the idea giver and other people will make it happen.
And I'm hoping that by having said it on Roof English Radio into a microphone, which is recording, I've also copyrighted the idea.
There you go. That's the cogs are starting to turn here.
Yes. You don't seem appalled by the idea,
no,
but
I'm
you
not
also
appalled.
Don't seem convinced by it.
I can kind of see, like, if they're in, like, if it's snowing around, and artificial snow, they'll have, like, a hot glass of Jólaglögg all year round. It can be a thing. But I can also, because a lot of Christmas in Iceland is kind of scary. It's kind of creepy. We have Grýla stealing children and putting them in her little pot. And
well, that could
them.
Be where the kids go.
Maybe.
While the parents enjoy an adult beverage.
Yeah, so the kids are getting cooked. in the hot pool.
Not literally.
Which is Grilla's, well, no, not literally. It's all part of the horror fantasy of Christmas,
Darren. Just to be clear, not literally.
So the pool becomes Grilla's pot, where she's cooking up all of the naughty children.
Exactly.
And yes, I think we can have an element of horror in this. See, for me, there's no Christmas without the horror of being eaten by a troll.
Right. Well, you've given me a lot to think about here. Certainly. And thank you for adding to the concept.
Yes, thank you. Can I be a part of this copyright thing?
Yes, which means you'll have to take some of the blame when it goes horribly wrong.
Okay,
which
great.
It probably
That's
will.
Fine.
But maybe we can reconvene and discuss again at some point.
Can we please? Right before Christmas.
Just before Christmas. It's a date. Ingrun, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
We've covered a lot of ground, I think it's fair to say, on today's episode of The Week in Iceland. More like a year in Iceland.
Yeah. And we do start rambling, you and I. We go into all of our brilliant ideas.
Yes. And as I say, a brilliant idea is now out there. Mm-hmm. We shall see if it comes back to me. Who knows? Ingrid Laura Christiansdottir, thank you very much indeed. We'll talk again here on Roof English Radio. My name is Darren Adam. You can get in touch anytime if you want to back the idea I've just come up with, for example, or any reason at all. English@ruv.is.
There's more from Roof English with all the news from Iceland in English at ruv.is/English. Roof English Radio is a daily English language radio from Iceland's national broadcaster, Roof.